Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Shifu, venerable, dear friends, today I will continue with the discourses on the Ratana Sutta. This is the jewel discourse. And so far I have spoken or explained the verses about the Tathagata as the peerless Buddha jewel. Then there come two discourses on the Dhamma jewel. One is on Nibbana as the, I call it the ultimate Dhamma jewel. And then the Samadhi, the concentration of the noble path, the world transcending path, I call it the efficacious or the effective Dhamma jewel. This is the Dhamma jewel as a means leading to the ultimate Dhamma jewel, the state of complete deliverance. Then last week, I spoke about the eight noble persons as representing the noble Sangha jewel. It's the Aryan Sangha, the Sangha of the Noble Ones. And then verse number 7 singles out the Arahants as, you can call them, the supreme Sangha jewel. The Arahants are those noble persons who have completed the development of the path, who have purified their minds of all ignorance, craving, and all the other defilements, and have attained the final goal of the Dhamma, the attainment of enlightenment, Nibbana, right in this present life. And now we come to verse number 8 of the Ratana Sutta. We are on page 25. For those of you who are following with the book, verse number 8, I will recite it first in Pali, then give a translation. And then explain.
Yatindakilo patavinsito siya chatuhi vatehi asampakampio tatupamangsa purisang vadami Yavarya sachani avecha pasati idampi sange ratanang panitang etena sachena suvati hotu.
Okay, the translation that I have that I would offer, it's a little bit different from that which is given in the book, just a little bit different. And I'll have to explain why it differs. Okay, the way I would translate the verse, just as a city pillar, there's a special word here that I'll explain, indakila, fixed in the earth, is not shaken by the winds from the four directions, even so, I declare, is the good man, or we could say the good person, we could eliminate this. it's called sexist language, good person, who by direct experience sees the four noble truths. This precious jewel is in the Sangha. By this truth may there be safety, security, good fortune, suwati. Okay, now in the large towns and cities, the large towns and cities of ancient India were almost invariably surrounded by a wall, a thick wall to protect them from attack, from invasion. And the wall would have a gate or door. And the door, of course, would close, and there would be a particular type of pillar which would be used that when the door is closed, that door locks into the pillar in such a way to keep it securely closed. That pillar is called Indakila. Inda is Indra. Indra is the king of the gods, Tianwang. And for some reason, I don't know what reason, this pillar is called, named after him, so it's called Indra's Pillar. Here I'm just calling it the city pillar. And generally, in order for the door to remain securely locked, this pillar had to be placed very deeply into the earth so it would remain securely fixed. I've never seen a picture of what one would look like, so I don't even have a clear visual image of it in my mind. I just looked up the explanation of it in the Pali English, the New Pali Text Society's dictionary. Okay, so the verse says that just as the city pillar, which is deeply planted in the earth, would not be shaken by the winds that come from the four directions. When the winds come, they blow in any direction, but that Indra's pillar doesn't tremble even a fraction of an inch, but it always remains firm and steady. Even so is this Sapurisa, this noble person, good person, who by direct experience, the word here, avecha, means one who has undergone the experience of seeing directly the four noble truths. And when one becomes familiar with the Buddhist suttas, the early Buddhist suttas, the Nikayas or Agamas, one knows that this type of expression, seeing the Four Noble Truths, is, you call it, a code word signifying a person who has achieved at least the level of stream entry. This is Rulio. What? Di Guo Ren. Chu Guo. The person who's achieved the first fruition. Now, usually, nowadays, we think that the Four Noble Truths are what we call like the basic introduction to Buddhism. But actually, if you read the Buddhist discourses, you see that the Buddha doesn't begin introducing people to the Dhamma with the Four Noble Truths. But the Buddha himself only teaches the Four Noble Truths when he sees that somebody's mind, somebody's faculties are ripe enough to understand them. Because the Four Noble Truths are the teaching special to the Buddhas. And so when the Buddha teaches them, he teaches for the purpose of awakening the person who's going to listen to them, to hear them. And so one who actually sees by direct experience the Four Noble Truths becomes, through that act of seeing, changes, we call it changes the lineage, changes over from the great mass of humanity, the great mass of ordinary people, and becomes transformed into an Aryan person. This is a noble person, a Shangren. Okay, so how does this seeing by direct experience of the Four Noble Truths, how does this come about? Okay, this direct realization of the Four Noble Truths comes about through the development of Panya or Prajna. And Prajna is developed in two stages, which I have noted on the outline. The first stage in developing this experiential wisdom is the stage of Vipassana wisdom. This is in Chinese, this is Guan, they call it Guan. But it's actually more than simply just examining, but this is very deep insight. And this insight arises through sustained attention to one's own bodily and mental phenomena. This attention has to be built up upon a foundation of samadhi, concentration. So first, the mind has to be focused, collected, brought to a state of unification. And then this is requires a lot of work, a lot of discipline, a lot of training. But when the mind is brought to a point, to a state of unification, of concentration, it then becomes a very, very powerful instrument for investigation, guan qia. And so one uses this powerful collected mind to investigate the nature of one's own experience, the nature of one's own existence. And the domain where this investigation takes place is, we call the five aggregates, panchakanda. Uyun. And so using that concentrated mind, one investigates, one examines the nature of the body, of form, examining the whole physical structure, internal and external. And as one uses that concentrated mind to examine the nature of form, experiencing the body at very deep and subtle levels, one comes to experience the body, the matter of the body, as in the process, the appearance of compactness or solidity in the body falls away, and the body is experienced as a stream of vibrations constantly arising and falling away. Arising and falling away. One directs the attention to feelings, perceptions, the volitional formations. They too are experienced arising, passing away. Arising, passing away. And as the investigation goes deeper and deeper, then that arising and passing away gets superseded, replaced by the perception of everything within the body and mind breaking up and dissolving moment after moment after moment. One continues this investigation through the body, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, volitional formations. Then one takes the investigation even into the most deepest hiding place of all, the place where ignorance hides in the most subtle disguises. The inner citadel of ignorance is consciousness, vijnana. And one investigates the mind, the consciousness, to see whether that too will give way under the light of investigation. And as one investigates consciousness, consciousness too reveals itself to be a process of states of mind, arising, falling away, arising, falling away. Then the rising and falling away gives way to breaking up, dissolving, vanishing, arising, breaking up, vanishing, until consciousness itself becomes just the stream of momentary thoughts which are always breaking, dissolving, and vanishing. And so there's nothing solid, nothing substantial left in this compound of mind and body, but everything is breaking up and dissolving moment after moment after moment. And so this is the development of insight knowledge. And since one is now seeing very clearly this breaking up and dissolving of all the five aggregates, one is seeing that they are all unsatisfactory, or let's say dukkha, in a sense, subtle forms of suffering. And since they are impermanent, unsatisfactory, there's no grasping upon them as being I, mine, or myself. And so one goes on contemplating these five aggregates as being impermanent, unsatisfactory, and non-self. And now as that insight goes deeper and deeper, eventually, if it's pursued to the deepest level, it comes to a point where the wisdom faculty presses right up against the very boundaries of the conditioned. And when it becomes very sharp, sharp enough, it breaks through the conditioned and reaches the unconditioned. This is the, we call the unconditioned element, the deathless state, nirvana. Just momentarily, the clouds of ignorance disperse just for a moment. The light of wisdom, now transcendental or supramundane wisdom, shines forth, and one now sees clearly the third noble truth, that is the cessation, what is the real cessation of suffering. And simultaneously with seeing the real cessation of suffering, one also sees directly the other three noble truths. One sees and understands fully that the five aggregates, being just empty, impermanent phenomena, are really suffering. One sees that it is one's craving and ignorance that keep one bound to suffering. And one realizes that it is this noble path, this path of wisdom that one has practiced, that leads to the cessation of suffering. And so with this, one reaches the penetration of the four noble truths simultaneously. And that is seeing by direct experience the four noble truths. And when it's by making that breakthrough to the four noble truths that one becomes a stream enterer, a sotapanna. Okay, now the verse that we're considering, says that, compares the Sotapanna, here called the good man, to the Indra's pillar that is not shaken by the winds from the four directions. Now, what exactly does this mean? You might think it means that the Sotapanna must have a mind of perfect equanimity, a mind that can't be shaken by gain and loss, praise and blame, pleasure and pain. If that's what you think, you're wrong. Because a Sotapanna can be quite an ordinary person on the outside. A Sotapanna has reached only the first level of enlightenment. The Sotapanna has eliminated only those defilements connected with wrong view. But the stream enterer could still have many emotionally tinged defilements. So a stream enterer, they don't have to be monks, they can be lay people. Stream enterers can fall in love and get married. They can have sexual relations. They can be proud of their children, attached to their wives and husbands. They can be, when people praise them, they can feel happy. If people criticize them, they can get upset. They get angry. They have all of these little defilements. If they get sick, they can become dejected. Venerable Ananda, the Buddha's attendant, was a stream enterer, not an arhant, while the Buddha was still alive. And when the Buddha announced that he was going to die, Ananda got so upset that he just went outside and started weeping like a child. Yet he was a stream enterer. So in what sense is a stream enterer one whose mind cannot be shaken by the four winds coming from the four directions? There's a clue to this. Did I eliminate the line that gave the clue? Anyway, it's on the reverse of your page. The answer comes in a sutta in the Sanyutta Nikaya. I won't read it, but you'll find it there, but I'll tell you the substance of it. In the sutta, the Buddha says that those ascetics and Brahmins who haven't understood the Four Noble Truths, okay, they go around looking up at the faces of other ascetics or Brahmins, thinking, this worthy one is surely one who really knows and really sees, really knows the truth, who really sees the truth. They'll go around from one, there were these different monastic establishments in India where the wandering ascetics would gather. They would come down from the Himalayas, meet there, then go wandering. So there would be people who would go around to these different monastic establishments and go looking for the sadhus, the swamis, the sannyasis, looking at their faces. Ah, this one, Swami Banananda, he must be the one who knows. This one, Swami Turiyanda, he must be the one who knows. This one, Sadhu Muni Mananda, he must be one who knows. And so they go around looking from one to another, thinking, this one knows, that one knows, or else with question marks, does he know, does he not know? This is like, we went through this like in the 1960s, early 1970s, people in my generation, when we became interested in Buddhism and Eastern philosophy, then suddenly there was this deluge of teachers coming from many countries in the East, there'll be announcements, this great guru is coming from India, this Maharaj. I was already a Buddhist at that time, but some of my friends would tell me, come, you have to see Maharaj. He's only 14 years old, but he's omniscient. He's the incarnation of Vishnu or Krishna. And so many people would be going to see him. Then a few weeks later, some other Swami would come from another part of India, and everybody would be going to see him and say, you have to go to see him. But I would always be quite stubborn and obstinate and say, I'm committed to Buddhism. Okay, so the Buddha says that these ascetics, this is like a tuft of cotton wool or kapok. When the north wind blows, it goes to the south. When the south wind blows, it goes to the north. East wind takes it to the west. West wind takes it to the east. So that is this kind of person. And even there would be some of the Buddha's own disciples, even though they became, some who became monks under the Buddha, still they had doubts. And then because the Buddha didn't practice the extreme ascetic practices, and so when they heard about another ascetic who would be fasting for 80 days, or maybe 80 days, okay, maybe this one has fasted for 30 days. Oh, and the Buddha is eating quite sumptuous meal, and he's clothing his body. This one is going naked, and our teacher is wearing a full robe, and this one only goes on alms round, and our teacher, he accepts invitations from wealthy householders. How could he be enlightened? So they gave up the Buddha and went to follow these other ascetics because they go naked and because they go around sometimes barking like dogs, thinking that's the way an enlightened person should behave. Okay, but then the Buddha says that those who understand the Four Noble Truths as they really are, they do not look at the face of another ascetic or Brahmin, thinking this one really knows, this one really sees. Then comes the simile. Suppose there was an Indra's pillar with a deep base securely planted, immobile, unshaking. Then if a blast of wind comes from any direction, that pillar would not tremble, would not shake, would not quake. Why? Because it has a deep base and is securely planted. And that's the way it is with those who have seen the Four Noble Truths. Okay, so that is the explanation of this verse on the stream enterer. This is actually the first verse on the stream enterer. Okay, now I come to verse number 9. Again, I'll recite the Pali and then give translation and explain.
Ye Arya Satmani Vibhavayanti Gambira Panyena Sudesitani Kinchapi te honti busapamata na te bhavamatamangadhyanti idampi sange ratanang punitang etena sachena Suvati hotu.
Okay, and going from verse 7 to verse 8, the Buddha has taken from his step down from the arahants as representing the Sangha jewel to the stream enterer as representing the Sangha jewel. Now in going from verse 8 to verse 9, we have three classes of stream enterers. And now the Buddha is going to take the most sluggish, the slowest, the dullest type of stream enterer and say that even this one represents the Sangha jewel. Okay, what are these three classes of stream enterers? The first type, we call the ones with the sharp faculties, is called a one-seeder. Not seat, but seed. I think it would be something like yi-jong. Yi-jong, like one seed. Like a seed that you plant in the ground. Because this person has one more existence ahead. Only one more existence. The middle grade are those who have anywhere from 2 to 6 existences. And the third grade, the most sluggish grade, are those who take 7 more existences. And what's characteristic of the stream enterer is that the stream enterer has cut off all existences beyond the 7th. Existence. Okay, so now I will give the translation of the verse. Okay, here we could take the translation from the book. Those who comprehend clearly the noble truths well taught by him who is endowed with profound wisdom, however exceedingly heedless they may be, they do not take birth for the 8th time. This precious jewel is in the Sangha. By this truth, may there be safety, security, good fortune. Okay, so in this verse, the Buddha is praising that most sluggish, that slowest of all the stream enterers, and holding this one up as being still qualified to represent the Sangha jewel, the noble Sangha. Because even though this is the slowest, most sluggish stream enterer, but still this person is way beyond the level of all of the deluded worldlings. This person, like all the other stream enterers and noble ones, has clearly comprehended the 4 noble truths taught by the Buddha. And this person does not take an 8th existence. They take only 7 more existences. And when the stream enterer takes rebirths, even if they take 1 rebirth, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, or 7 rebirths, those rebirths always take place either in the human realm or in celestial realms. They never take rebirth in any of the lower realms. They've cut off any possibility of rebirth in the bad destinations. I'll come to that in the next verse. But I just want to turn to some suttas. There's a collection of suttas in which the Buddha is praising the achievement of those who have attained stream entry, even the lowest degree of stream entry, and giving the reasons. We have this, again, it's in the Samyutta Nikaya, chapter 13. There are 11 suttas. And I've put in the appendix, I've put two of them. In one of them, the Buddha takes up a little bit of soil in his fingernail, and then he asks the monks, what do you think is more, the little bit of soil that I have in my fingernail or the soil on this great earth? And the monks say, the little bit of soil that you have in your fingernail is very tiny, but the soil on the great earth is very great. Then the Buddha says, so too for a noble disciple, a person accomplished in view who has made the breakthrough. That breakthrough is the attainment of stream entry, the breakthrough to the Dhamma. The suffering that has been destroyed and eliminated is more, while that which remains is trifling. It doesn't amount to even a 100,000th part of the mass of suffering that has been eliminated, since there is no more than at most 7 more lives. Of such great benefit, monks, is the breakthrough to the Dhamma. Of such great benefit is it to obtain the vision of the Dhamma. Then in the next sutta that I quote here, the Buddha says that he compares 7 grains of gravel to Mount Sumeru, the king of mountains. And just as the king of mountains is so much greater than those 7 grains of gravel, so the Buddha says that the achievement of a noble disciple who has made the breakthrough to the Dhamma is so much greater than the achievements of all the ascetics, Brahmins, and wanderers of other sects. They don't amount to even a fraction, a fragment of the achievement, even of that most sluggish, that slowest stream enterer. And there's one story that's always appealed to me very much. It comes in the collection called the Udana. There's a leper named Supabuddha, who's a very poor man who goes around wandering through the towns looking for a bite to eat. He's completely illiterate. He's like he's out of the caste system. He's regarded as untouchable. And he just goes around where people gather for picnics and sees if they leave any food behind so he could collect something to eat, or he goes begging. And one time he comes to a park and there's a big gathering and he sees it and he thinks, ah, a big gathering here, maybe I can get something to eat. He starts wedging his way in, trying to see through the crowd what's going on. Then he sees that, it's the ascetic Gotama, the Samana Gotama, that's the Buddha. He's teaching a great crowd of people. Maybe I should sit down and listen to him teaching. So he sits down and listens. And while the Buddha is watching the crowd, he tunes his mind in, he's observing the minds of the people, and just like a radar system, his mind picks up this leper Supabuddha, and he realizes that this man has the potential to realize stream entry. And so he starts teaching the Dhamma, sort of directing it specifically to Supabuddha the leper. And while he's teaching, right on the spot, Supabuddha the leper becomes a stream enterer. Now what strikes me it's very astonishing. This poor man who goes around begging, can't even write his own name, by penetrating the Dhamma, he has understood the nature of consciousness, the nature of existence, the three characteristics of being, dependent origination, more deeply, more thoroughly, all of these things more thoroughly, the nature of time, the nature of space, the nature of causation. We have this man on one hand. We put on the other hand the greatest philosophers, Plato, Aristotle, Descartes, St. Thomas Aquinas, Descartes, Leibniz, Spinoza, Kant, Hegel, Whitehead, Russell. I won't spare the Chinese philosophers, Lao Tzu, Confucius, who are some of the others, the Indian philosophers, Shankaracharya, all of them on the other side, the ones who have written big books, Being in Time, Being in Nothingness, the Phenomenology of Internal Time Consciousness, Space, Time, and Consciousness, volumes and volumes. And this guy can't even write his own name, but he has understood these things more deeply, more vastly than these philosophers have done. And not only that, but he can, because he's realized the state, he can dwell, he can sit down, cross his legs, and dwell in a state of sublime bliss and peace beyond that of anything available to the wealthiest millionaires, billionaires, who have the entire world at their command and control. Even though he doesn't have a penny to his name and has to beg his meal from one day to the next. Okay, the next verse. This verse has two extra feet.
Saha vasata sana sampadaya tayasu dhamma jahita bhavanti sakkaya ditti vichikicchitancha sila patang vapi yatadi kinchi Chatuha payehi chavi pamuto chachabi tanani ababo katum idampi sange ratanang panitang etena sachena suati hotu.
Okay, this verse describes what happens at the moment that stream entry is attained. Okay, I will read the translation. Though I like to translate it my own way, actually. Just remodeling this translation a little bit. Together with the acquisition of vision, three things are abandoned by him. Namely, okay, identity view, or you could view of self, doubt, and clinging to rules and observances. He is also absolutely freed from the four states of misery and is incapable of committing six deeds. This precious jewel is in the Sangha. By this truth, may there be safety, security, good fortune, peace. Okay, earlier I described how one progresses through the development of insight, that is vipassana panya, insight wisdom, till one reaches that breakthrough to the Dhamma. That breakthrough to the Dhamma is also called the arising of the eye of Dhamma. The eye that sees the Dhamma. And so, for this reason, that experience is also called the achievement of vision. Because now, with the achievement of that experience, with the arrival of that at that experience, one sees into the innermost truth of the teaching, the innermost truth of the Dhamma. So one acquires the vision of the Dhamma. And at that very moment that the vision of the Dhamma takes place, the moment that the eye of truth opens and one sees the deathless, sees Nibbana for the first time, simultaneously three fundamental defilements or fetters, this is jia, fetters of the mind, are permanently eradicated. Fetters that through beginningless time have been keeping us in bondage to samsara, the round of birth and death. What are these three fetters? One is called Sakkayaditti, Sajjajya, Sajjayajyan. Okay, what is Sakkayaditti? We call it identity view, or here it's called self-delusion. Not so accurate. I think view of self is better. This is the view that there is a real self existing in some relation to the five aggregates, either as identical with the five aggregates. The five aggregates, as you know, are bodily form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, consciousness. So, Sakkayaditti, identity view, is the view that there is a self which is either identical with one or another of these five aggregates, which possesses them, which is inside of them, just the way a jewel might be inside a lotus flower, or a jewel inside a casket. Or which contains them, the way the casket might contain a jewel inside of it. But all of these views, in their different formulations, all center around some conception of a real, truly existing self. And now through the by attaining this penetrating vision or insight into the true nature of the Dhamma, one sees that any kind of self is a delusion, a mere figment of the imagination. And so all views of a true self, an existing self, are immediately cut off and can never arise again. one has now seen the truth of the Dhamma for oneself. One has seen the truth that the Buddha himself has realized. And so one has no more doubt that the Buddha, that the ascetic Gotama, Samana Gotama, is the Sammasambuddha, the perfectly enlightened one, the Tathagata. One has no more doubt that the Dhamma that he teaches reveals the true nature of things. One has no more truth, no more doubt that there are other noble ones who have practiced the path and realized the Dhamma. One has complete confidence, unshakable confidence in the Aryan Sangha. And since one has followed the training, followed the practice, one has no more doubt that this practice leads to enlightenment. And with this achievement of the breakthrough, one knows that all of the different religious observances and vows and rituals and ceremonies that people undertake in the belief that simply observing these rules, undergoing, practicing these ceremonies, making these vows, undergoing these rites, that these by themselves are sufficient to lead to liberation. All of those wrong views about these practices drop away. This doesn't mean that one gives up precepts, gives up religious observances, that one no longer participates in liturgy recitations, religious rites, and so on. One will do so as a way of training the mind. But one doesn't cling to the belief that just by undergoing these rites and rituals, one could purify one's mind and gain liberation. Okay, so one abandons these three fetters, chatuha payehi cha vipamuto, one is liberated from the four states of misery. One is never, can never be reborn in any of the lower realms, the hell realms, the animal realm, the realm of the afflicted spirits, commonly called hungry ghosts. And here is unusual, but the text adds, the fourth realm is the asura realm. And then a person who has achieved this vision, who has reached the state of stream entry, can never perform what is called six crimes in the book. Actually, five of them would be crimes. One of them is not really a crime. They're actually called, first five are called heinous deeds. Okay, what are these five heinous deeds or crimes? One is killing one's own mother. Another is killing one's own father. Third is killing an arahant, a perfectly purified, liberated being. The fourth is maliciously wounding a Buddha. It's impossible to kill a Buddha. A Buddha always dies through the expiration of his natural lifespan. But one might attempt to kill the Buddha, as Devadatta did, and one will fail, but one might wound him. But that is still a terrible deed. And the fifth one is maliciously attempting to create a schism in the Sangha when the Sangha is living in harmony. One who commits any of these five terrible deeds, it is said, creates such heavy bad karma that they will be immediately in their next life reborn in one of the lower worlds, in the hell realm. And an ordinary person, one who has not reached the level of stream entry, even though we might be very virtuous, very well disciplined, we still remain capable of committing one of these deeds. But when one reaches the level of stream entry, it's impossible to commit one of those five deeds. And what is the sixth deed that the stream enterer can never commit? It's not really a crime. It is to look up to any other person but the Buddha as the ultimate spiritual teacher. So one who is not yet reached stream entry, I've seen this in Sri Lanka. I don't know if this should go on the recording. Many Buddhists there, very devout Buddhists, but there's a yogi, a spiritual teacher in India named Satya Sai Baba who performs miracles. You know, he's supposed to open his hand and like powdered incense comes out or gems come out. And he performs like little miracles like that. And he tells you things about yourself that he couldn't have learned from anybody else. Well, many, many people there in Sri Lanka, though they continue to call themselves Buddhists, but they become very devoted to Sai Baba because he's just a short trip away in South India, and they become followers of him, and they go to visit him at his ashram, and then when they come back, they have Satya Sai Baba devotional societies, even though if you ask them, what is your religion? They'll say Buddhist, but their enthusiasm is all Satya Sai Baba, Sai Baba, Sai Baba. And so this is, in a way, it's like looking up to another teacher. But when one achieves the true insight into the Dhamma, one doesn't look up to another teacher. And so even though one has not yet reached that level, but still we should try to make a strong determination not to let ourselves be like the cotton or kapak in the wind, following other teachers just because they might observe strict ascetic practices or perform miraculous feats, but follow the teacher who shows true wisdom and great compassion. Okay, that will be my talk. Maybe first we'll share the merits.
Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mangparang. Etavata ca amhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhiya. Etavata ca amhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhiya. Etavata ca amhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampatti siddhya.